Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Good morning and welcome to the Morning Briefing for Friday, October 6th, 2017. I'm your host, Eric Dame. Jake Hughes is your producer running things, and you are lucky you tuned in today because the last show of this week, it's a good one. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll speak to Rob Jones of Rob Jones Journey. Now, Rob's been on the show before, so you might remember him, but if you don't, Rob is a Marine Corps veteran who lost both legs to an IED in Afghanistan, and since then, well, he's been bringing attention to disabled veterans in amazing ways. For example, he's won a medal in the Paralympics. He's ridden his bike across the country, but his current endeavor, which starts off in 1 week, is even more impressive. He's running 31 marathons in 31 days in 31 different cities on two prosthetic legs. Then we'll speak to the Director of Programs for the Veterans of Foreign Wars, Lynn Rolfe. While the VFW's Legislative and Claims Assistance Services run out of D.C., their programs to directly support the military and veterans are run out of Kansas City. And that's where Lynn is doing his incredible work. He'll call into the show in just a bit. And later, we'll be joined by a former JAG officer who's been featured everywhere from GQ to RT as a subject matter expert on veterans' legal issues. His name is Eric Montalvo, and he's going to talk to us about the legal issues surrounding Sergeant Bergdahl, Private Manning, Lieutenant Rapone, everybody's favorite cast of military members and veterans. So, stick around today and start your Friday off right, beginning right now, as Jake joins us in studio. Good morning, Jake. How you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic. How you doing, Eric?
Pretty good. It's a Friday. I had a great day yesterday. As I mentioned on the show, I was the MC of a ceremony over at the Disabled Veterans for Life.
That's right. How
Veterans
was that?
Disabled for Life Memorial in D.C. It was fantastic. I got to meet Secretary Shulkin over there. I got to meet Senator Duckworth, Representative Frankel. Mr. Reichard, who's the Reichhoff, who's the founder of IAVA, and almost all of them I was able to talk to, and one of them in particular, who happens to be the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, said, you know, it's nice to finally meet you. We talk about you almost every morning. It's nice to say hello in person. He was like, yeah, well, how about I come on your show and we can talk in the morning? And I said, all right, let's do it. So hopefully we'll have Secretary of the VA, Dr. Shulkin, before too long. Senator Duckworth, I didn't get to speak to her too much because she was coming over from the Senate where a vote was going on, came over for the ceremony, and then as soon as she was done with her part, her speech in the ceremony, essentially had to take off and run back over there so her vote would be counted. But it was a beautiful ceremony at a beautiful memorial. You know, I had driven by that memorial before, but I'd never actually been able to take the time to visit it. And yesterday I got there plenty early. You know, that's how we do in the military. We get there early for everything. Got there, walked around. It's an incredible place, a beautiful place that I would submit is one of the hidden gems of Washington, D.C. And it came about in large part because of one of the speakers yesterday who I had the privilege of introducing, Lois Pope. Now, Lois is a philanthropist, and her first tie to the veteran community was actually as a performer and entertainer on like USO shows. I believe in Vietnam, I think, is when she was doing most of what she was doing. And her experiences there had a significant effect on her as she made her way through life. She came into quite a bit of money. And, you know, there's a lot of rich people out there, and we could point fingers and name names, but why are we going to do that, Jake? There's no reason to it. Kardashians, I'm looking at you. What are they doing? Just, I don't know what
they're famous for being famous.
They're spending money on, like, good phones for their Instagrams and MySpace pages.
Yeah, phones for their dogs and stuff.
Lois Pope has spent a lot of her money to help out the veteran community, and she was the key, really the big key behind getting that memorial done. And then yesterday, the ceremony I was the MC of was for the inaugural National Veterans Disabled for Life Day. It's actually a holiday now, you know, a nationally recognized day, again, in large part due to Lois Pope, as well as her her Congress representative, Representative Frankel. Really just an incredible thing and an honor to be a part of it, and I enjoyed every moment of it. We have a little video on ConnectingVets.com of our own Matt Saintsing, who was there working it, speaking to Representative Frankel, asking her about the importance of veterans, and As I learned when doing the research on everyone that I was introducing, Representative Frankel is big into veterans issues because her son is a Marine.
Oh.
There's a lot of ties to Congress that I think a lot of people don't realize. You know, you hear it all the time, people saying, well, yeah, well, why don't the senators and the Congress people send their kids off to fight first, huh? Then maybe they'd think twice about war. Well, you know what? There are quite a few of them who have children, nieces, nephews, relatives serving in the military. And that's an example right there of Representative Frankel, who represents the West Palm area down in Florida. Got the chance to speak to her after the ceremony. Again, just a really, really fantastic program. They put a lot of effort into it, and I'm really, really glad that I got to be a part of it. It was a really, really interesting and fun time. Yesterday to, you know, celebrate our wounded warriors. Rob Jones is going to join us in just a couple minutes here, about 5 minutes or so. He's going to call in. Rob Jones was present at the ceremony yesterday.
Oh, really?
I saw he was going to be there, I added him into my introductory remarks and spoke about the amazing things that our disabled veterans are doing out there. And I don't know if there's a better example than Rob Jones and Senator Tammy Duckworth, Congressman Brian Mast. There are a group of disabled veterans that are very visible doing amazing things, but it's also important to remember that there are those who may not be that visible who are also doing incredibly important things. Again, just an honor to be part of that. And I'm sure we'll have more pictures and stuff up of that coming up on, you know, Facebook and Instagram and things like that. I took some yesterday. I couldn't take any during the ceremony. I thought about it, but I was like, you know, that would probably look bad if I were whipping out the phone to take pictures of people speaking. But yeah, it was
senators and congressmen, but first let me take a selfie.
Yeah, let me take a selfie as the Secretary of the VA is delivering his remarks, or as Senator Duckworth is making her poignant and strong remarks. Of course, Senator Duckworth losing her legs and partial use of her right arm in a helicopter. Well, her helicopter went down after it was hit by RPG fire, and she told that story. There was a little video before she got up and spoke where she credits the pilot of that aircraft. She was the co-pilot, was saving her life, and a great example of that camaraderie and that, really that close relationship that you have when you're in the military. And apparently, if it weren't for that pilot refusing medical care until they dealt with her first, she probably would not be with us, and then would not have become a congresswoman, would not have become a senator. I mean, it's amazing what the efforts of one person can have, that sort of butterfly effect. That pilot saying, you don't touch me until you work on her. And the doctors and medics, it's a triage situation. And when a lot of people don't understand this or don't like it, but you deal with those who you're going to be most likely to save first, instead of essentially, and it's a horrible term to use, but wasting your time on a lost cause.
Right.
They thought Tammy Duckworth was a lost cause. Turned out they were wrong. She was anything but a lost cause. And thanks to her pilot demanding that she receive medical care before him, she's with us today. So really a lot of amazing stories told over there, and a lot of attention being brought to great issues involving our disabled veterans. Another issue, this Rapone kid, man. He's a gift that keeps on giving if you work in the media, because it's like, as I said to someone yesterday, I can't believe that every day something new seems to come out. And yesterday, as first reported by the Daily Caller and then picked up by other organizations, apparently West Point had a pretty good idea of what his ideas were, and he was espousing them pretty openly on campus while he was there.
Really?
It was written up for it by a lieutenant colonel who was a professor at the school, who I guess he was making a lot of noise in his mentor's office. And that's a whole nother story that I think there may be some more coming out of eventually there. You know, we're going to have to see exactly what happens with it. But thankfully, we're going to have Eric Montalvo on in our feature interview segment coming up in just a while. He is a former Marine Corps JAG officer who's been featured on GQ. I mean, he's been involved in several high profile cases. He's kind of a media expert when it comes to the legal issues surrounding the military and veterans. And he's going to join us on the morning briefing coming up in our feature interview segment. And I've got some questions for him about Rapone. We're also going to talk about Sergeant Bergdahl. Can you believe that guy's a sergeant? Doesn't it? I mean, it's because the trial hasn't even begun yet. So he hasn't yet been reduced in rate. You can't do that. But he's still Sergeant Bergdahl.
He's an embarrassment to the NCO Corps. As a former NCO, that's all I can say.
Yeah. We're also going to talk about Private Manning, who recently, because of the felon status, was not allowed into Canada, which that's Jake's reaction to it. All right. So we've got a whole bunch coming up, as well as the programs director for the VFW. But without any further ado, I want to welcome back to the show our friend Rob Jones. Good morning, Rob. How are you doing today?
Morning, guys. How are you?
We are doing fantastically well. And as I mentioned, I was at the Veteran Disabled for Life Memorial National Day of Honor, the inaugural commemoration of that yesterday. And you were out there. And as I spoke to you, I realized I knew we'd had you on the show before. The month of marathons kicks off in October. And then you reminded me it actually starts like a week from yesterday. You're headed over to England this weekend where you're going to kick off the month of marathons. So how are things going in preparation for that?
Yeah, man, we're in the final preparations here, loading up the RV today, did all my food preparation, packed it up, and flying over to England tomorrow to get set up over there and hopefully finish everything, so I'm ready to rock.
And, of course, people, if they don't know, robjonesjourney.com is the website, and Rob is a double amputee. He's a Marine who lost his legs to an IED, but that hasn't slowed him down not one bit. Already ridden his bike across the country, competed and medaled in the Paralympics, and now 31 marathons in 31 days in 31 cities starting across the pond. That's got to make things a little bit more difficult for you, Rob, don't you think? Actually starting things off over in England and then having to travel back for the next day for the marathon. What was behind the decision to go ahead and do that?
Yeah, it certainly makes things a little bit more logistically challenging and maybe a little bit more physically challenging just because of the time changes. But you know what? America's not in these wars alone. We have allies, and those allies, veterans, have the same troubles as we do over here. So I think we should all unify together and work on it as a team.
Now, as you said, you've prepped the RV because after London, you've got 30 more days of marathons, and you mentioned food. So here's a question that just popped into my head. What kind of food are you going to be eating to keep up your energy? Because 31 marathons in 31 days, that's an insane amount. Most marathon runners aren't running. Like the ones who win marathons aren't running 31 marathons in 31 days. So what's your diet and what's your schedule going to look like for those 31 days?
Yeah, you know, it's going to take about 4,200 calories a day just to run the marathon and be alive. So, and then there's extra calorie requirements to recover. So I'm going to be eating tons of food. My breakfast is going to be 6 eggs, 4 slices of bacon, some pork rinds, a banana. I'm going to eat 2 energy bars a day. I'm going to have these 2 big slices of this low-carb lasagna. I eat a bunch of sweet potato chips, a bunch of broccoli, tons of food. It's going to be almost as hard to eat the food as it is to run the marathon, I think.
That does sound like an incredible amount of food. And then, I mean, you're eating your breakfast and then running directly after that, or are the runs taking place at different times in the day? How's your schedule looking?
You know what? I'm not actually going to eat anything before I start running. I probably won't eat my first energy bar until about halfway through. Because that's going to maximize my ability to utilize my fatty acids that I have in my body already. And then I probably won't eat my first full meal until after I finish.
Now, I saw a video on social media that you posted as you were doing your prep work, which when it comes to running 31 marathons in 31 days, that prep work involves a lot of running. And there was a video where you're running and your running blade appears to have either shattered or come off. I'm not sure exactly what happened in the video. Tell us a little bit about that video and what your message was behind it as well.
I think my message behind that was, well, the video, you'll see me running away from the camera, and we were shooting a promo, and you know, serendipitously, I had a little mishap. So my, I think a screw must have come loose, and I didn't realize it, and so the screw lost its structural integrity, and then when I landed on that foot, it snapped and shot off to the side, and I went down pretty hard, but I was okay. But you know what? My my message with it was, you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs, and in this case, you can't push yourself to your limits without breaking a few legs. So you know, if you're gonna push yourself as hard as you can, then there's gonna be a little bit of risk associated with that, and you know, I'm willing to take that risk.
Absolutely. And we're speaking with Rob Jones. You can visit robjonesjourney.com to keep an eye on his progress, as next week he is beginning. And we've talked to him before about this. He's been prepping for quite a while now. He's going to run 31 marathons in 31 days in 31 cities. Really a tremendous undertaking. And as I mentioned, we were both at the Veterans Disabled for Life Memorial, the inauguration of the National Day of Honor for Veterans Disabled for Life yesterday. Sitting in the crowd there and hearing Senator Duckworth speak, hearing Don Overton speak, did that make you even more invested in your activities that you've been undertaking as a disabled vet yourself? I mean, how did it feel sitting out there and hearing their stories and seeing your fellow disabled veterans talk about everything they've been through?
Well, you know, they're all just more examples and more evidence to the assertion that just because a veteran comes back wounded doesn't mean they come back broken or disabled and or incapable of contributing to society. And I think that those guys, the senator and the other gentleman, they both prove that we can still contribute regardless of our injuries.
And that is an important aspect of it, and something that I think too many people focus on. You know, the disabled veteran, when they look at you and your identity, they think, oh, you know, he's someone who doesn't have two legs, he can't do A, B, or C. Then they don't think about the things that you can do and how you're able to overcome these impressive obstacles that have been put in front of you. It just doesn't matter to you, does it? You're going to be able to do what you want to do, and you just have that drive, and you know that you're capable of doing it. Is that how you feel?
Yeah, you know, and those people, they're not thinking those things maliciously. They just don't know. They've never witnessed it before, so I think by me doing this and by the senator becoming a senator, we are providing evidence and we're showing them so that people can know.
You know, and it's one of those things when you're over there, and of course I served in Afghanistan for a tour up in RC North, and when you heard about someone being injured or you knew someone who was going back, it was almost spoken about in hushed tones, like, well, what are they going to do when they get back? Oh man, their life is going to be so much different. Obviously life is going to be different, but life doesn't necessarily have to be worse, does it, Rob?
No, and I mean, I think that the message I'm trying to send out is just when you face with such a tragedy or a hardship such as being injured like that, you can actually use it as a tool to make yourself even better, make your life better, and make the lives of other people around you better. So yeah, it definitely won't be worse unless you want it to be or you make it be worse.
Now, as you head into the 31 days, you've been preparing for it for a while. You are a Marine, so I know that you believe you will be able to do this and you will be able to get through it. Do you have any concerns heading into that month of marathons, whether it be, you know, something like the issue that you had with your blade when you were practicing and shooting the promo video, or something else? I mean, what are your biggest concerns as you head into this month of marathons that you think, if anything can keep me from finishing it, this would be this?
You know, I've tried to plan for every contingency, so I have, you know, 3 or 4 spare running feet that I'm going to have. I have a bunch of spare parts. So I think most of the things that would stop me from being able to do it are kind of out of my control at this point. You know, there's a lot of logistical issues, or not issues, but logistical planning that's gone into it. So, you know, if the RV breaks down or something, that could cause a problem. So things kind of have to go just right. But, you know, I think that they will, and I feel confident about it.
So as the 31 days begin, and as we need to point out to everyone, it's not that, you know, you're not running the New York City Marathon, the Boston Marathon, all of the, it's not specific events that you're running in necessarily, but you are running a marathon, that distance for 31 days, and your schedule as it's firmed up, are there any particular days that you're looking forward to on your journey?
The last one. But no, I'm looking forward to all of them, really, because it's just an opportunity for me to bring this message to a new audience every day, and big audiences, so I can just get the message out there and get it in front into the public eye in each of these cities, and then they can spread the word, and I hope it'll just compound from there.
Now, at that memorial yesterday, I was privileged enough to MC the event and was able to introduce the speakers. And in my intro, I mentioned that you were in the crowd after I saw you there. I made sure that you were mentioned in the intro, and the round of applause from the crowd as loud as the round of applause for the senator, for the secretary. So it seems there are quite a few people who are aware of what you're doing and are supportive of it. How has the public support and the awareness of what you're doing, how have you seen it grow over the last few months?
Oh man, it's been growing incredibly ever since I've started trying to get the word out there. I've seen a bunch of RSVPs on all of my runs. You can go to my website and sign up to come out and tell me that you're going to be coming, and I've seen a bunch of those, and so the public support's been incredible. I've gotten, you guys have had me on the radio, I've been on TV a few times, I've been recognized by a few people. So it's definitely picking up. So, and that's good, because that spreads my message.
And that message, exactly, it's so important. It's so important to realize that our disabled veterans, they're disabled in one way, but they're incredibly able in other ways. So your other disabled veterans out there, those who may be, maybe more recently disabled than you are, maybe those who haven't had time to come to terms with exactly what's going on in their life and how life is going to change, not necessarily for the worse, but definitely going to change. Are you hoping to be able to reach out to them through this and just set an example for the disabled veteran community and those who might be struggling with their disabilities?
That's my main objective, is to raise awareness within the veteran community that they are still capable, and some people might not believe that. And so I hope when they see me being able to do such a hard task as this, then they can kind of use that as an example and envision themselves being able to do something that they believe will contribute to their family or their society.
So you're starting off over in London, and of course, any of our London listeners, if those exist, they can of course check it out there. What day are you coming back to the States, and what are the first few dates of your month of marathons back here?
Yeah, I'm London, October 12th, and then Philadelphia, October 13th, then New York the next day, Boston, Toronto, Detroit, and then I think Louisville after that.
Wow. So really, you're hitting a lot of the big spots, and hopefully a lot of people pay attention to what you're doing. And I hope a lot of people join you as you're running there. How excited will you be to have anyone joining you out there to run with you? I mean, if it's just one person even, is that going to be enough for you to make you happy?
Yeah, as long as, it could be zero people running with me, as long as there are people that are seeing my message and hearing it and spreading it to the veterans that they know and to the civilians that aren't familiar with military and the issues that we have.
You know, Rob, and we've been speaking with Rob Jones Journey. We've been speaking with Rob Jones of Rob Jones Journey. You can go to his website, robjonesjourney.com. I know you haven't even kicked off the month of marathons. You're still a week away from that. But are there any ideas kicking around in your head for what might be next? Is there anything that you're maybe thinking of or considering, or are you not sure yet?
I haven't been thinking about what's next a whole lot just yet. Maybe some kind of a stair climbing thing. But besides that, I'm focusing on this. And then, once inspiration strikes me after I've rested enough afterwards, I'll probably start having some ideas.
Very cool. And when it comes to stair climbing, it comes to doing things. I mean, as you've been preparing, you've been doing others. I know that you were up in New York City for the Tunnel to Towers run up there, been really active and really, really working to bring attention to these issues. And also, I know your lovely wife. I've seen her on social media. Seems like you've got somebody there who is distinctly in your corner and extremely happy to be working alongside of you. I am very proud of you, as are all of us in the veteran community. And Rob, we wish you the best of luck on those 31 days of 31 marathons. And if people want to find out more, where can they go and what should they do?
Hey, go to my website, robjonesjourney.com. You can contact me there. You can sign up to run. You can donate. You can buy a t-shirt. And then all my social media is at Rob Jones Journey. I'll be updating every day, probably from now until I finish.
We've been speaking to Rob Jones of robjonesjourney.com. 31 marathons in 31 days, kicking off now in less than a week. 6 days from now, he'll be running his first marathon in London. That's right, flying over to London this weekend, flying back afterwards, and then he will start 30 more days in the United States and Canada. So if you would like to find out more, as he said, robjonesjourney.com is the website, and he would love it if you get out there and run with him. Or at least spread awareness of what he's doing. Morning Briefing, back after this.
Helping military veterans stay connected.
We make it easy.
We are CBS Radio's ConnectingVets.com. Connecting vets every day.
Online and all over social media. Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter at Connecting Vets.
Wrong song. That was the song from the last hour. Welcome back to the Morning Briefing. I'm your host, Eric Dame. Jake Hughes is your producer on the other side of the glass, making sure I don't do anything too stupid in here. And ConnectingVets.com, it's your website. And we mean that. Created by veterans, for veterans. ConnectingVets.com is keeping an eye on everything taking place in and around the veteran community and letting you know about it. Now, we'd love it if you visited ConnectingVets.com, I don't know, every half hour. So that would be, what, 48 times in a day? See, I'm not that bad at math. We know that's not that likely. So if you follow us on social media, you'll be kept up to date on the latest and greatest, everything new that goes up there. We are at ConnectingVets on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. So far, Jake Hughes has failed on getting our new MySpace page up and running. And yeah, no, your apologies mean nothing, Jake. We need that MySpace page to reach the largest audience. Don't you agree, Mr. Eric Montalvo?
Absolutely.
Yeah, if you don't have Tom in your top eight, are you really living your best life on social media?
Of course not.
Of course not. Our next guest is a former Marine. He was an enlisted Marine and then became one of those officers, not just any officer, but a JAG officer in the United States Marine Corps. Since then, he's become, well, involved in several high-profile cases involving the military, as well as one of the most respected legal analysts when it comes to the veteran community and the military community, specifically relating to law. He is Mr. Eric Montalvo. Eric, thank you so much for joining us on the Morning Briefing today.
Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. Now, as I mentioned, you served in the Marine Corps and had a pretty interesting career, a varied career, I would certainly say. So tell us a little bit about yourself, where you came from, when you joined, and what you did during your time in.
Sure. So I'm a Yankee from New York.
What part?
Long Island.
I moved down here from Long Island.
Oh, really?
Huntington. Yeah. I
was living in Rockville Huntington.
Center. So. Oh, okay. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. So St. Agnes Catholic boy, enlisted in the Marine Corps to get out of trouble, got into more trouble.
And the Navy recruiting office was closed, I assume?
Yeah, well, yeah. They wanted me. I was actually contracted to go Navy subs. And then
you're a crazy person.
Yes.
No, okay, there you go. Because your two options apparently were going on subs or joining the Marine Corps. That's, wow.
Yeah. So I get in the Marine Corps, and all of a sudden I found myself in a tank battalion. And then the next thing I know, I was in the middle of the Gulf War dealing with that. And I enlisted. Became a sergeant, came back to the East Coast, and somebody said, "Oh, you might make a good officer." And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And so I figured that out, became an officer. They made me a supply officer. I wasn't really happy with that because I wanted to blow stuff up. That's kind of my personality. And I wound up being a supply officer, and then, did that for a tour, was with the artillery battalion and Marine Division, and then you know, applied for the law program, got selected. And so I did MESEP, did the 2 years. I had an associate's degree by that time. I was going to night school,
right,
at University of South Carolina. And did the JAG thing, went to Temple in Philly. And then, you know, got my cheesesteaks for a few years. I was there during 9/11. So that was tough because I was the only military guy, you know, for miles. So having to explain a lot of that. And then finished that up, came back, and did the remainder of my career as in the JAG Corps. And my last tour of duty was at the military commission's Guantanamo Bay stuff.
What was it like serving in the JAG Corps? I mean, that's something that it's one of those things. We think of it, I think, a little bit separately, obviously a part of the military, but it's such a separate entity that is so different from everything everybody else seems to be doing in the military. The JAG Corps, the Chaplain Corps, the Medical Corps, kind of their own unique worlds. How did you like your time in the JAG Corps?
Well, you know, the good thing about the Marine Corps is that, you know, we all have this common bond. We went to either boot camp or the basic school, and so we all draw from the same, you know, well, and, you know, we have that common bond. You know, becoming a legal professional was an interesting change. You know, you gain a new language, a new perspective on how you view problems and solving them, and you see, you know, some of the best in us and some of the worst in us. You know, when you're dealing in criminal law, you see some things you wish you hadn't seen. So
it's one of those things when people tell me, they find out I'm a veteran and they say, oh, I respect everybody who serves. And I say, everybody? Because I knew some dirtbags while I was in. There's some people that you might not respect that much if you knew the details.
Yep.
no matter where you look, every house has some garbage inside of it. You know what I mean?
Yep,
so as you finished up your career, you served for, I believe, over 20 years, right?
21 years.
Yes, 21. Right. That's a long time. I only did 13 and that was plenty for me. 21 years in the Marine Corps, it was your life, essentially, for over two decades. What do you remember about that transition period, about leaving the Marine Corps, and how did that go for you?
Well, you know, the Marine Corps is small, and it's a family, so it was tough leaving the family. You know, really good people, people that were hurt, people that were killed, you know, while I was on active duty. So it was part of my life. It is my life. I mean, I'm a Marine. You know, they talk about, you know, you call them a sailor, you call this whatever, but, you know, you transition and you become a Marine. And
right.
That's who you are. It's an identity. So, you know, one of the things, you know, that we harp on in the Marine Corps, and, you know, I think it's important, is integrity. And we live it a little bit in a vacuum because it's a controlled environment. And the real world is not exactly adhering to the, you know, honor, courage, commitment principles in the same way.
Not necessarily.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, confronting that and, you know, it used to be that my word meant something when I said it, that was what was true. And I didn't have the same traction in the civilian community. I was no longer Major, you know, prior enlisted Montalvo. I was, you know, Eric Montalvo, you know, in the, you know, probably not as good of a suit as I had now, but, you know, it evolved. I had to learn how to, you know, work within, the civilian legal community, and that broadened my perspective on things. And, I, you know, in my role as now as a founding partner of a firm, you know, I have a supervisory capacity, and I can't give the same, you know, butt chewings, if you will.
it's a little different. And that's something I think in particular with Marines, and we've talked to, one comes to mind, one of the very first guests we had on the program is Brian Stan. Brian Stan, who was a Marine Corps Silver Star recipient, started fighting mixed martial arts professionally while he was in MMA, or while he was in the Marine Corps. And then when he transitioned out, didn't trust MMA to pay the bills and got a job working in the business world, essentially, and realizing that not only was he this combat veteran Marine, which is intimidating enough by itself as he went into the office, he also was coming out of training with like stitches on his face and cuts and things like that, and realizing that, you know, your background, while it's impressive to some people, can also be intimidating, and it can be kind of a barricade if you don't realize that you kind of need to personalize yourself to those other people and kind of change your tack. Because, you know, Captain Stan from the Marine Corps, he said, was able to bark out an order. Marines were going to do it. Major Montalvo was able to do the same thing. Eric Montalvo, working at his law firm now, probably not the best course of action with other people who have law degrees and all that stuff we're working for.
Absolutely. In point of fact, one of the things I did find was that it was a hindrance for the most part because people look down on you. I had spent 21 years in an institution that most people don't even understand. And then as a lawyer, I had no roots in the legal community from their perspective. So I didn't have any skill sets. I didn't have any bona fides that transfer over. And I was speaking a different language. And this integrity thing was like, you know, what are you talking about? You know, we're litigating. So, you know, it was a completely different environment, and you have to assimilate. If you want to succeed in the civilian community, you have to transition away from Sergeant Montalvo because, you know, we're not PTing at, you know, 5:30 in the morning anymore. That's just not how it works. We're not, you know, out in the field, you know, pushing each other around or on the rifle range, you know, qualifying. That is not the environment that you're living in anymore.
Well, in those people's defense who think that you were speaking a different language, I did 13 years in the Navy, and I don't always understand what Marines are saying. It's usually a series of, like, grunts and things like that, you know. Of course, I'm kidding. Although I do tell people I wanted to join the Marine Corps to do the job I did in the Navy, but they wouldn't let me in because I passed the reading test. Take that. You're listening to The Morning Briefing here on CBS Radio's ConnectingVets.com, and we are joined by Eric Montalvo, Marine Corps JAG officer in his past life and in his current life, an officer and also kind of a subject matter expert that the media has turned to anywhere from GQ, RT. We can look at various other places that you've been because you have that background. And you've also, I believe, remained involved in some cases involving the military after you've gotten out. And we wanted to talk to you about three specific items that have been in the news lately. The first one that's near and dear to our hearts here at Connecting Vets, because we broke a part of the story that's relating to, of course, to the 2nd Lieutenant Rapone from the 2nd Combat Brigade of the 10th Mountain Division up at Fort Drum, West Point grad, previous 1st Battalion Ranger, who that's the part that we broke, that he was actually released for not meeting standards from the 1st Battalion. This guy, we had a story on our website the other day about how a lot of veterans seeming to think that his espousing of communism and some of the things that he put online might account to treason. And under Article 106A, which covers espionage and treason of the UCMJ, there are a lot of people who thought this guy should be executed. Maybe a bit extreme for someone espousing values in uniform and not actually having taken any action that we're aware of on it. But from your perspective, looking at that story and then looking at the new info that we have that was just broken yesterday, I think the Daily Caller reported it first, that apparently West Point had already written him up for similar things, that this was an issue while he was at West Point, was still allowed to graduate. How do you look at this case and also the public perception of it for those who are not veterans and how they're looking at it?
Sure. Really complex set of issues. You know, you have the First Amendment issues, you have military discipline issues, you have discredit upon the service, you know. So let's talk about, you know, first of all, do you have a right to enlist in the service? Do you have a right to a commission? And the answer is no, right? Yeah. The services discriminate against all sort of people. You know, if you're out overweight, if you're too short, if you're too tall, if you're, you know, so there's a need for the military, and it's a very specific need, and that's to be a warfighter or supporting a warfighter and make that happen. So the fundamental question is, what is in the best interest of the service, right? Not necessarily the individual. And that means that we can discriminate, and we have to look at what the fit is. And looking at it through that lens, I think fundamentally, as a policy, do we want someone in the service that is espousing, you know, these ideas in a way that's contrary to, you know, our democracy, and that's of concern. And so that's a fundamental fit issue. That doesn't mean he can't be an American. That doesn't mean he can't vote. That doesn't mean, right, he can't run for office. But it does mean that when he's in a fighting hole with somebody else, does he truly have the passion and commitment to do the things that he needs to do when under fire to support and defend the Constitution of the United States? And that his actions and conduct and statements raise a question in that category in my mind. So then we determine, okay, how do we resolve that? So you have a criminal path, and then you have an administrative path. I think that based on what we've seen thus far, it seems like this should take an administrative path, not necessarily a criminal path. I think he's crossing some lines, but effectively, I think the service needs to fire him. And that would be through an administrative path because he's not a good fit.
Right.
Whether that's a good of the service discharge, whether that's an other than honorable, because you know, his recent statements against General Mattis as a Secretary of Defense, I think certainly do offend. But I think the conversation could be had in an administrative discharge board or board of inquiry for an officer, and you know, he can explain why he's doing what he's doing, and if it doesn't pass muster, the service can determine he doesn't belong there anymore.
It's also an interesting case because social media is a relatively new invention. I mean, when I joined in 98, there wasn't any social media. There was no Twitter. There was no Facebook, MySpace. I mean, I guess GeoCities was probably around back then. That was the closest thing. This is something that is fairly new. And in talking to members of the retired JAG community specifically, no one seemed to have any case they could refer to involving social media. The closest things that they saw were dating back to the Vietnam era and people, you know, writing cartoons and putting them in a newspaper, an underground letter, something like that.
Sure.
Do you think that this could... Is there any possibility that this could go the criminal route because the military might want to actually have something to refer to when it comes to social media, or is that not typically how the military court system works?
Well, looking at it through the lens of criminal law, what did he do, right? So criminal law breaks up into two basic categories. One part is what you call mens rea, what did he think? And then the actus rea is what did he do? And so in this case, it's the doing part that's of concern. And then you have to, and that informs you as to what he was thinking when he did it. So when we look at that, you know, the code, I think, reflects a number of different things that are not novel and could play out. One, Article 133, which is conduct unbecoming.
They all seem to think that that one would be on the table.
That's a no-brainer. Yeah, right. And that's a catch-all. And, you know, I think his conduct is unbecoming. You know, he's disrespecting the uniform. You know, there is this line, you talk about social media, so there is a private nature of conversation and there's a public nature of conversation, and he's deliberately stepped into his uniform to, you know, proselytize some of these, you know, positions. And he can do that, but there's a consequence, right? You know, he can say in a private conversation, maybe in a bar, that he doesn't agree with, you know, Secretary Mattis. That's okay. That's a private conversation. But when you put it out there, if you start advocating and pushing a policy or you know, political, you know, orientation, you know, the rules have been on the books for a long time. So I think social media is actually something that is, there are actually many cases that address social media convictions. You have people that engage in, you know, like child porn activities and, you know, they have that. You have, you know, domestic violence where, you know, they have a record of that in their Facebook or what have you. You have, you know, sexual misconduct, you know, where, you know, you have videos and all of these things. So, I mean, social media, since its inception, you know, it used to be photos.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, Marines and photos, you know, we look at some of the war crimes that occurred, you know, over the past, you know, 20 years and, you know, those were captured by photos. That was the, you know, old school social media. So all social media is doing is capturing more of what is out there and allowing the evidence to come forward in an easier manner. So I don't know that it necessarily changes the nature of prosecution. I just think it makes it easier because if you're saying stupid things and putting it out there yourself, then you kind of have to own it.
Yeah, internet's forever, man.
That's right.
None go away.
That's exactly.
From this new report, again, that was first broken by the Daily Caller, now other organizations have it, Cadet Rapone at the time at West Point, according to the lieutenant colonel who filed the complaint on him, apparently implicitly justified the actions of ISIS and blames the United States for terrorist attacks. A lot of people having questions, and this isn't even a law question. This is a college question. How was this person allowed to graduate and become an infantry officer in the United States Army with something like that on their record? A lot of questions about that. But this story, I don't think it's over. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens. Again, in our article, which you can find on connectingvets.com, for former JAGs, including U.S. Air Force JAGs, one former military judge. his thought was that the second lieutenant would be offered the what they call a RILO, resignation in lieu of. So he would basically be told, you can resign or you can face these charges under the UCMJ. A lot of the other ones thinking quietly, get rid of him. Don't give him any more of a platform. Article 15. And one of your fellow Marines specifically saying, and then you go after him for the tuition from West Point because he did not complete his contract, essentially, after graduating from West Point. When you don't do that because of your own actions, you can be forced to pay that back. So an interesting situation and one that we will keep an eye on. We're speaking with Eric Montalvo. Eric is a retired Marine JAG officer who has a wonderful first name, I need to tell you. It's the best name. I don't know why everybody doesn't have it. He is, of course, also a practicing lawyer now and a subject matter expert who's been featured everywhere from GQ to RT and numerous other media outlets talking about military law because that is his area of expertise. Next story. Bo Bergdahl, still a sergeant, as I was telling, and Jake, our producer, he was a drill sergeant in the Army. Staff sergeant when he got out. Not happy that Bo Bergdahl is still an NCO, but that's the way it works as the judicial system works its way through. To this point, he is still a sergeant in the United States Army. I'm sure you've been keeping an eye on that case. Where do we stand exactly on that, and how much longer do you think it's going to be before we see the court-martial trial of Bo Bergdahl?
Sure. So, you know, the game in defense is delay. I think that's the dirty little secret. You know, the longer you can draw these things out, the better. more pay, more time to work the case.
And do you think they're trying to hope people will maybe forget it about a little bit and maybe things, other things will draw more attention?
Sure. You know, things soften over time. You know, the visceral reactions, you know, when it first came out. But I think that they've chosen a form. The military judge has control over the situation. I see this, you know, all of the motions that seemingly could have been filed. So the pretrial practice is pretty much over. So now they're into, you know, litigating, you know, the facts and see if they meet the two crimes, you know, of desertion and misbehavior before the enemy. You know, choosing a military judge makes me think that it's going to go a lot sooner than it would otherwise because you don't have the problem of, you know, jury selection and not getting panel members and having the, you know, one of the big things for the defense was undue command influence. And, you know, this is when, you know, people, you know, superior to the convening authority or the person who, you know, puts forward the charges, the general usually, in a general court martial, you know, was influenced by, you know, president's statements by the president or senators or these types of things. So by removing the jury from that selection process, you've eliminated a lot of issues, also a lot of appellate issues, because, you know, when you go through the panel process, you'd have to say, did, you know, President Trump or President Obama or did anybody influence your position on this case? Did you hear about the case?
Right.
By having a judge alone, it's sort of neutered a lot of that. So I do think that some of the big problems in the case have been eliminated. The judge has control over it, and it'll be a lot more efficient and timely.
From the layman's perspective and from the veteran perspective, the military perspective, when I got to Afghanistan, I started hearing some things about Bergdahl. He was still in the possession of the Taliban at that time. My understanding of the case grew rapidly once I got on the ground over there and started hearing various things from various people about that issue. From our perspective, it seems like this is an open and shut case. It seems like the guy left his post. He left his weapons behind. It's clear that he was deserting, whatever his desire for desertion was, whatever his means and method were. It seems clear, open and shut. But is that necessarily the case? I mean, do you think this is going to be a case that's kind of up and down and there's going to be more to it than it seems at the surface?
You know, I don't know all of the, you know, integral facts that the defense has, but in gross terms, one of the problems with the desertion case is, did you ever intend on coming back?
Right.
And if the defense can sell to the military judge that there's some fact or indication that, you know, this was not a permanent departure, that, you know, it was a momentary lapse of stupidity, even though the desertion can happen in a moment, if the government has to prove that he formed an intent at that time never to come back.
Right.
Sometimes that's hard because you don't know what the guy was thinking, and you have to look at the context of the situation. He may have been suffering from some mental disease, you know, that, you know, makes him a little, you know, wonky, or, you know, he wasn't thinking quite straight. It doesn't mean he's innocent, but it doesn't mean that he committed that offense. So within desertion, you also have Article 86, which is lesser included. So it's possible he may not get, you know, convicted of the desertion because of the lack of permanence in his intent, but he may get hit with the AWOL. As far as the misbehavior in front of the enemy, that's going to be a tougher charge because it hasn't been put forward very often. It's really, you know, a holdover from World War II.
Right.
You know, the judge is not going to have that much context. And, I think the judge will want to protect the record and not create issues for appeal. So he's going to want to make it as clean as possible. And within an 86 or an 85 charge, he can get a significant amount of punishment to begin with.
Yeah, and it's a very interesting case. And as you said, you know, that mental illness factor, I think, may come into play because there's got to be something wrong with you to leave your post. Now, his claim was that he was trying to go to another, I believe that he was at an outpost and he was looking to go to the main base in the area to report some sort of thing that he didn't agree with at his outpost, but left his weaponry behind and just went crawling out into the bushes in Afghanistan. That's certainly not something that a normal person does. So it'll be interesting to keep an eye on that. But we want to thank Eric Montalvo, who has been our guest, retired Marine and current practicing lawyer, who is a subject matter expert, gave us some great information on the Rapone and Bergdahl cases. Eric, if people want to find out more about you, more about your current practice, where can they go to do so?
Sure. www.fedpractice.com.
Fedpractice.com. And don't forget to visit ConnectingVets.com. And we are at Connecting Vets on all social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. This is the end of our Friday show, and we want to thank you so much for joining us. We will be back Monday with a brand new slate of guests and some fantastic shows for the rest of the week. Have a great, safe weekend. On behalf of myself, Eric Damon, producer Jake Hughes, see you later.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? We make getting custom window treatments a minor project with major impact. Choose from premium blinds, shades, and shutters. We even have options for your patio, too. Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Our design experts can help you find the perfect window treatments on your schedule. We'll even send free samples directly to you. Plus, we can handle the measuring and installation for you. Unlimited window treatments installed for just one low cost. And with Blinds.com, you'll always get transparent pricing. No hidden fees. Our free shipping and 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step. And into your home, too. Shop Blinds.com right now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off for a limited time at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.